Professor Tim Thornton, who's come from UCLAN, just down the road.
Uh-huh.
He's going to talk on the manifest metaphysics of essential philosophy of sci-fi.
So, there's always a point in workshops where it kind of descends into pub philosophy, and I think we've reached that point here. I wish I had a thesis. So I'm going to wing it a bit. So I'm going to be slightly autobiographical, which is kind of deeply embarrassing. Here's the overview of the talk that I want to go through. First of all, I want to say something about my take on Rachel's question, and then I want to tell you an anecdote about the Oxford textbook of philosophy and psychiatry. And then I'm going to do some other things. They're up there, but that's what's going to happen. So my take on the question is this. One obvious way of answering the question whether the philosophy of psychiatry needs metaphysics is to think, well, what do we mean by metaphysics? And a way of doing that is not to go back to Aristotle. It's just to think, how do we learn what metaphysics is in an average undergraduate program? Well, one, I don't know whether average or not, but one undergraduate program is the one that happens in Cambridge, where, interestingly, there's a division of labour. So a student is advised by a director of studies, is taught by lecturers, and is examined by examiners. And they're all different people. And there is no necessary connection between any of them. One's director of studies might say, if one has announced that one's going to take the metaphysics paper, well, why don't you go along to Smithers' lectures on the philosophy of time, Carruthers' lectures on causation, those other lectures on free will, and so on. You tootle along, take those lectures, and cross your fingers that the entirely different people who set the exam a year earlier have coincided in their thinking about metaphysics with the lecturers who are providing the lectures. So if that were the case, and just taking those three which have just come to mind, so philosophy of time, well, I'm not sure. Phenomenological psychopathology is interested in disorders of time. Certainly, thinking about philosophy of causation, notions of etiology in the philosophy of psychiatry, and thinking about free will, questions of mental capacity come into play. And so a quick way of answering Rachel's question is to say, well, the philosophy of psychiatry needs metaphysics insofar as the philosophy of psychiatry advances metaphysical claims. Since it obviously advances metaphysical claims, it obviously needs metaphysics. Jobs are good. That's the end of it. But I take it that the spirit of the question is more in the way that there was a lurking presence of Arthur Fine in the first two talks, which is to say something like this. There is a natural ontological attitude, a description of the surface phenomena of the philosophy of psychiatry. And then there's an additional bit, the table thump of really, if you're a scientific realist from the 1970s, according to Arthur Fine, there's some other stuff lurking beneath the surface. And then Rachel asked the question, do we need the stuff that lurks beneath the surface? And I thought an excellent question asked earlier of her was to say, well, in suggesting that just because you can do the stuff on the surface without the stuff underneath the surface, we shouldn't be interested in the stuff underneath the surface, begs the question against metaphysics. Because the metaphysician is going to want to say, but that's the bit we're interested in. And so it's quite difficult to ask the question in the spirit that Rachel is asking it and provide an answer in a theory-neutral way. But that's the sort of thing that I'm going to try and approach. And you'll see in about 20 minutes that I've failed. So I get no better than the glib answer, sadly. It gets no better than that. That's just as far as it went. Here's the little anecdote about the Oxford textbook of philosophy and psychiatry. This is a textbook which is co-authored by Bill Fulford and myself, and oh, this is recorded, so I can't say that bit. Okay. There was an interesting thing I could have said at that point. The origin of that book is that it was put together as a result of teaching material that we wrote together. I got involved in teaching the philosophy of psychiatry as an ex-Wittgensteinian, Davidsonian, McDowellian, jobbing ordinary philosopher, because Professor Fulford dragged me by the arm and said, come and teach in my course for free. And I said, what's in it for me? He said, nothing. Everyone else I learnt that he asked that question of said, bugger off. But I was free that Monday afternoon and so got sort of sucked into it. And kind of one thing led to another, and so we wrote the teaching material, and then that went along to become... Suddenly he arrived one day to say, I've sold it to Oxford, it's going to come out as a textbook. And I said... Ought we perhaps to think about the coherence of the project and go through some of the underlying disagreements that we have? I said, oh no, it'll all just come out in the wash. It wasn't a problem. And I'm not here to sing the praises of any of either of the two books that I've been involved in, but insofar as the Oxford Textbook of Philosophy wasn't a complete disaster, it wasn't a complete disaster by chance that Bill Fulford's anti-reductionism in the concept of disorder sat happily with my anti-reductionism in the philosophy of mind and language, and sat quite happily with my pessimism about an algorithmic approach to the to method when it came to the philosophy of science. The surface appearance was quite harmonious. But to stick with the sort of metaphor that I'm using to think through Rachel's question, the underlying underpinnings of that was quite different. Bill Fulford, when it comes to values, is a subjectivist. And I was a sort of neo-McDowellian, neo-Aristotelian objectivist. On the surface, they are the same insofar as they're anti-reductionist. But one position thinks that there are values out there in the world, and the other thinks that the values are all just in here. And only later, this anecdote finishes soon, don't worry, but I've got very few slides. This is the best bit. I was in Paris at the invitation of a nice chap called Pierre-Henri Castel, and just to prove that I was doing some... I could tell you funny things about that. I asked him where the university was on the Sunday that I arrived, thinking I'm going to spend the next month here with him. He said, the university is in our hearts. I said, no, well, that's lovely, but where is it physically? He said, oh, we never go there. I'll let you know if I want to see you again. So there I was, marooned in Paris by myself. And so I did some writing, and I wrote a paper against Bill Fulford's subjectivism in values-based practice. And I sent it to Pierre-Henri just to say, look, I have done some work whilst I've been out here. And he read it and said, that's super, Tim, but you can't publish it. It would be patricide. You cannot do this to your philosophical father. And years later, Bill began to take notice of the fact that fundamentally, at the metaphysics of all these value judgments, we just disagreed like mad. Interestingly, he doesn't care. He thinks it's just interesting that there are debates in the philosophy of psychiatry. Nothing needs to be settled. Settling it risks paternalism. It's better if the philosophical debates are all in flux. Curious. Okay, so I want to say something about the essential philosophy of psychiatry, which is the book pretext that I'm here. The rationale for writing it was that the book series, which now has nearly 60 books in it, didn't have an overview book. All the books were quite expensive. I wanted to write a cheap one, and I thought I would write a kind of neutral overview. And so that's what I did. However, when you try and write a neutral overview, it's hard to be neutral. And so what I want to do now, I mean, I don't think that this is a great book, and I'm sort of standing away from it and looking back in order to give this presentation. I want to think about some of the arguments in that book and then think about Rachel's question with respect to them. The book, just for reasons of making it look user-friendly, it was divided into three sections called Values, Meanings and Facts, hey-ho, and in each of them I offered some, it turned out, generally anti-reductionist arguments. An argument that we couldn't reduce disorder to the plainly factual. Disorder was value-laden. We couldn't reduce moral judgments to moral principles. We couldn't understand meaning or mental content by reducing it to inner representations, on the one hand, nor, on the other hand, to ongoing conversations. I'm going to say something a bit about all of these. And we couldn't reduce expertise to codified principles. When I was writing these slides last night, I couldn't remember what happened in the sixth chapter in the book, so that's not here, but probably something similar happened. So let me give you a little snapshot of the sorts of arguments that the author of that book put forward. And so this is a sort of the feel of how in the chapter on the concept of disorder the argument went. I appeal to the idea, Thornton, appeal to the idea that mental illness looks value-laden. That was it. It looks value-laden because it looks as though illness carries with it a notion of something being wrong with one. And so then I looked at attempts to give, despite that appearance, a plainly factual account of it, and I argued that such accounts didn't work. So, for example, one argument in the chapter was that the most plausible value-free account is based on the notion that there is at least a value-free core to disorder. I'm thinking of Jerry Wakefield here. And that that value-free core can be analysed in evolutionary theoretic terms. And given that evolutionary history is a plainly factual matter, as Darwin has taught us, then the core of disorder, at least, is plainly factual. There's the argument. And then I pushed an objection which went, ah, yes, but when we're telling that evolutionary just-so story, we don't just pick out the totality of the causal happenings, we pick out a particular explanatory story that makes a certain sort of sense to us. And in doing that, we presuppose the very form of normativity that this account was supposed to discharge. So the notion of disorder remains essentially a normative notion. I no longer think that that argument works quite in the way that I thought it at the time, but that's a sketch of the kind of, that's a sketch of that argument. Here's a quick, these won't take terribly long, there are five of them that we've done on this, and then I just say some pub stuff. That's the deal. So the reduction of moral judgments to principles. Consider the following idea, that understanding any genuine concept can be codified by giving the principle or formula, and here's a quote from McDowell, that specifies the conditions under which the concept, in the use of it that one has mastered, is correctly applied. In other words, imagine the idea, the assumption, that all genuinely cognitive judgments must be governed by an explicit rule. We've got that in mind. But then we go off and we read a little bit of Wittgenstein and we realise that even in the case of judgments where the judgments can be so codified, deploying the principle in practice, deploying the principle in media res, in the moment of saying that indeed is an apple juice, requires a kind of practical judgment. That I take it, or took it in the book, to be the moral of Wittgenstein's rule-following considerations. Well, once we realise that, we're no longer scared by the thought that maybe it's not the case that every genuine cognitive expertise is underpinned by a rule. Because we can see that even where there are rules, there's something that looks to be practical and context-dependent which is underpinning them. So if that's the case, there's no need to reject the appearance of moral judgment. Because moral judgment looks to be context-dependent and practical rather than codified by principles. And we no longer have a philosophical prejudice that blinds us to the apparent facts. Hence, there's no need to think that moral judgment's reduced to principles. That's the story of that. Normativity of meaning, well, more familiar stuff. Cognitivism fails, constructionism fails. Okay, that'll do. A chapter on the philosophy of delusions. Now, I take it, borrowing a lovely phrase from Naomi Eilen, that the challenge to the philosophy of delusion is to solve simultaneously for understanding and utter strangeness. So what we want to do as philosophers is we want to butt up against Jasper's thought that primary delusions were ununderstandable. And we want to do this in the following nuanced way. We want to recognise that there's something really strange about primary delusions, and yet we want to pick away at the thought that we can make nothing of them. And that, I take it, is what philosophical accounts do. Now, in the chapter, I was really concerned just with things like the two-factor model of delusion. So here's a sort of summary of it. Appearing, if we use a one-factor Mayer-style account and we say that a delusion is a rational response to an unusual experience, the problem about that is that that doesn't solve for understanding because we can make nothing of the unusual experience. But further, given that there are people who suffer those unusual experiences but don't maintain them as delusions in the face of a diagnosis from a friendly clinician who tells them what's going on, we need to add in a second factor, hence the two-factor account. But the problem is that adding in the second factor may solve for strangeness. We now say this subject has a bizarre experience, but then doesn't believe you when you tell them, look, that's just a bizarre experience because of some quirk of their reasoning, but now we don't understand the quirk of the reasoning. Either way, you can't solve for both. And so the argument went, the project of reducing delusion to something more familiar lapses, it fails. We can't reduce delusions to something more familiar. I would have written that chapter quite differently now in the face of things like Andy Egan's account of bimaginings and so on and so forth. A PhD student of mine has taught me a lot about that. And then a story about facts. So here the thought was, in the face of the rise of evidence-based medicine, and in the face of the hierarchy of evidence in evidence-based medicine, which puts at the top meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials, looking to the very general, to very big populations, and puts at the bottom the expertise of a clinical expert, I wanted to write a chapter in which I suggested that there was no way of sustaining the hierarchy, that crucially, what you need in order to run the top is a form of expertise at the level of the bottom, because what you need to spot is the relevance of the general population to the patient in front of one. And that spotting of relevance is not itself a matter of the very general. It's a matter of the particular. So the idea of reducing expertise to essentially context-independent general algorithms was never going to work. So those are the things that, as it were, against my better judgment in trying to write a theory-neutral introduction to the philosophy of psychiatry, nevertheless emerged. They came out. They were there in the chapters. So what is it that gathers all these things together? What, if anything, gathers them all together? Well, I mean, something does. I think there are some things, there are some resemblances between them. And one story is that they're all anti-reductionist. One might say this, they're all anti-reductionist. Or they're all anti-reductionist naturalist, if you want. So people who have been influenced by that sort of, by John McDowell and people who come after him, we want to rescue the word naturalism from a transatlantic assumption that the word naturalism goes with reductionist naturalism. Let me just say something about that just to remind us all. So here's the project. A concept looks really puzzling. What should philosophers do with it? Well, we can show that it isn't that puzzling if we can show that it actually fits into nature in a non-puzzling way. How do we show that this concept fits into our conception of nature in a non-puzzling way? Reduce it to something more basic that we accept without qualms. That's reductionist naturalism. And the aim of anti-reductionist naturalism is to respond to the puzzles that philosophy sets us, not by reducing things to a core of nature, but by finding a way to expand a nature that's unpuzzling so as to allow in these features, these apparent features of the world. So some, at least, of my little book opposed this lovely paragraph from Fodor. I think I've written 6 books and I've quoted this in all of them. It just seems it's great to have an argument for reductionism. I used to be able to quote it without reading, but I'll read it now. So this is Jerry Fodor in his book Psychosemantics. So it's a book about intentionality or meaning as applies to mental content. And he says, I suppose that sooner or later the physicists will complete the catalogue they've been compiling of the ultimate and irreducible properties of things. When they do, the likes of spin, charm, and charge will perhaps appear upon their list. But aboutness surely won't. Intentionality simply doesn't go that deep. It's hard to see, in the face of this consideration, how one can be a realist about intentionality without also being, to some extent or other, a reductionist. If the semantic and intentional are real properties of things, it must be in virtue of their identity with, and then there's a sort of weakening brackets, or maybe their supervenience on, properties that are neither intentional nor semantic. And now we have a lovely jocular pun for the transatlantic folk. If aboutness is real, it must be really something else. So here's a manifesto for reductionist naturalism. The thought is, the catalogue of the really real is being unpacked by the physicists, and eventually we can imagine that that's finished. We have a concept, and we wonder whether this is a concept that picks out something which is genuinely out there in the world. Well, there are 3 options. Either this concept is already on the list, or it's reducible to the list, or it isn't on it and it's not reducible. Well, if it's the third one, it's not a concept about the really real. It's not real. That's the thought. Anti-reductionism, of course, I used to set this as a thing for in my introductory lecture to the incoming philosophy undergraduates at UCLan and say, what's wrong with the argument? And it's one of those things where, of course, we can immediately spot not necessarily what's wrong with it, but what somebody like me would say is wrong with it, namely that it just assumes that physics is the benchmark of the really real, and it provides no explanation for that. That's just assumed. If you accept that, then the argument goes through. But this paragraph itself doesn't provide us any further reason to believe that. And so there is a thought that large amounts of my little book were anti-reductionist in this sense, that they were anti-reductionist naturalist because the book was happy to accept that the world contained more things than would be found in physics or reducible to physics. The world contains meanings. The world contains moral values. That's the story in the book. But if that's the case, then this doesn't fit the conception of metaphysics that I think would be is in the spirit of the way Rachel has asked the question. Because the problem is, this is on the manifest surface of essential philosophy of psychiatry. It's all over the surface of it that it's an anti-reductionist book. This is one of the reasons why Dominic Murphy hated this book so much. There is not a hint of reductionism in it. He wrote a scathing review called Relaxing into Psychiatry. He was good enough to email me to say, my girlfriend has just told me that I should warn you that I've just written a scathing review of your book. I said, that's fine, Dom. That's absolutely fine. Just make sure you write a lovely first paragraph about me. And so he duly wrote, Tim Thornton is bright, young, lovely chap or whatever. And so that's now on my CV, and I ignore the rest of I ignore the rest of the review. So two problems with thinking about this in answer to Rachel's question. One is, as I say, it's on the surface, it's not underlying. There's no way you could do the claims that I make without the metaphysics, because claiming that the world contains moral values, and anti-Fulford, thinking that that's not just a matter of human sentiments being projected outwards, but it's actually a feature of an extended view of what's natural, that's just a metaphysical claim, it seems to me. I don't know what metaphysics is, aside from pointing to undergraduate Tripos, but saying there really are moral values seems to me as metaphysical as it comes. Secondly, however, it doesn't fit, for example, my pessimism about the philosophical analysis of delusion. That's not a pessimism formed on the basis of a worries about reducing delusions to biochemistry and hence physics. It's a pessimism about reducing delusions to other content-laden mental states. Further, it doesn't fit my scepticism about the idea that moral judgments depend on moral principles, because again, there aren't moral principles to be found either on the physicist lists or reducible to them. Moral principles are another way of conceiving of moral judgment, which the book rejects in the way that it does, but not as a piece of rejection of reductionist naturalism. That makes me wonder if I've got kind of 5-10 minutes, I don't know. 10 minutes, okay, great. What would be a conception of underlying metaphysics if you're the sort of person who isn't primarily thinking about a philosophy of science, an Arthur Fine notion in which there's the surface phenomena of the natural ontological attitude and there is a suspicious underlying realm that one may or may not want to subscribe to? If that isn't your bag philosophically, is there a way in which there might be underlying metaphysics that has action at a distance? And racking my brains sitting on the train last night, the only thing that I could think of is a sort of Foucauldian paragraph in my hero John McDowell's Mind and World, the book where it all goes wrong, I have to say. Pre-1994 is the John McDowell of choice. But anyway, there is this one moment in this where he offers a kind of analysis of why the world hasn't been proto-McDowellians for the last 300 years. And he says, in trying to diagnose the rise of scientism and reductionist naturalism, he says, what's at work here is a conception of nature that can seem sheer common sense, though it was not always so. The conception, I mean, was made available only by a hard-won achievement of human thought at a specific time, the time of the rise of modern science. Modern science understands its subject matter in a way that threatens, at least, to leave it disenchanted. The image marks a contrast between two kinds of intelligibility, the kind that's sought, as we call it, by natural science, and the kind we find in something when we place it in relation to other occupants, spelling mistake there, sorry, of the logical space of reasons. If we identify nature with what natural science aims to make comprehensible, we threaten at least to empty it of meaning. So if you identify nature with what Jerry Fodor identifies with nature, then there can't be meanings in nature directly. They'll have to earn their place through reduction. That's that thought. By way of compensation, McDowell continues, so to speak, we see it as the home of a perhaps inexhaustible supply of intelligibility of the other kind, the kind we find in a phenomenon when we see it as governed by natural law. So here we have the possibility of a bit of metaphysics lurking underneath, which has an action at a distance later in people's philosophy. And the thought goes either way. The reason why people are vulgar reductionists is that they mistake the methodological advances of 17th century science and scientific methodology as a metaphysical insight. That's a mistake. You don't need to think that. You could just think that it's a really good way of doing natural science to understand a subset of natural phenomena. Reading this paragraph produces an action at a distance for the anti-reductionist. They suddenly think, wow, we just don't have to buy Fodor's initial assumption that physics is the benchmark of the really real. That assumption itself is a product of 300 years of thinking, but it's optional. And because we spot that it's optional and nothing holds it in place, and given also that it has unpleasant actions at a distance elsewhere for philosophy, we can with a clear conscience reject it and return ourselves just to looking at the phenomena. It looks as though value judgments are disciplined by values out there. That's the thought. Okay, so a last thing. So if not metaphysics, what else might have bound together some of the claims made in that book? And here I think a better thought is something like this. The book is filled with a kind of anti-explanatory quietism, which is a broader philosophical commitment than just a metaphysical commitment, although sometimes the metaphysics and the way of doing philosophy go hand in hand. So, for example, reductionist naturalism, as I've just mentioned, invites a conception of philosophy that the right thing for philosophers to do is to reduce puzzling concepts to bits on the physicist's lists. If you believe in reductionist naturalism as your metaphysics, it gives you American naturalism as your approach to philosophical method. So metaphysics and general metaphilosophy can go hand in hand. And my little book was filled with the thought that we didn't need to reduce anything to anything, that all we needed to do was have a good look around and sometimes just return things to the surface. And that's why I wanted to show you the form of some of the arguments in it in those earlier slides. Lots of them just take the form of saying, look, have a look, that's what it looks like. Not an argument at all. The argument was in the form of saying, first, let's diagnose your bias, which stops you from having a good look. But once we've done that, just have a look. And so the thought that I have there is that the action here, I'm looking for something which is a kind of a commitment that has an action at a distance later on. And it's typically this sort of Wittgensteinian thoughts. Philosophy must not interfere in any way with the actual use of language, and so it can in the end only describe it. For it cannot justify it either, it leaves everything as it is. Philosophy just puts everything before us and neither explains nor deduces anything. Since everything lies open to view, there's nothing to explain, for whatever may be hidden is of no interest to us. The name philosophy may also be given to what's possible before all new discoveries and inventions. The work of the philosopher consists in marshalling recollections for a particular purpose. Now, this, I think, fits the structure of that book rather more than a single metaphysical commitment. It's a sort of weird lack of ambition when it comes to providing any form of philosophical analyses. And there was another not very nice review by Neil Pickering, where because the book criticised Neil Pickering's lovely stuff on the likeness argument, which I have to say I think is a wonderful book and a wonderful idea, but nevertheless I criticise it in this book. And Pickering says, well, Thornton criticises me, but you turn the pages in vain to find his analysis of the nature of disorder! True, there is no analysis of disorder in my book. I didn't think philosophy was in the business of doing that, frankly. Now, that wasn't an explicit aim of the author of Essential Philosophy of Psychiatry. That person didn't set out to write an anti-theoretical book. Rather, that's just what emerged from an engagement with the current state of philosophy of psychiatry 10 years ago. So there's a sense in which this is both manifest, it's there on the surface of the book. I make no bones, there are no analyses. And yet, on the other hand, it's underlying. It's a metaphilosophical commitment to how one might go about doing philosophy. Two slides and then I'm done. Why do we hold such philosophical commitments? Why are vulgar reductionists vulgar reductionists? Why are lovely and refined anti-reductionists lovely and refined anti-reductionists? Why are quietists quietists and so on? I want to suggest, and this is just, I'm in the pub now, I want to suggest it's not because of antecedent arguments. You don't provide an argument to become a reductionist from a non-reductionist starting point. You're sort of born as one, it seems to me. You're cajoled into being one by influential lecturers and so on. You're not persuaded of the truth of general reductionism or anti-reductionism by arguments, even though arguments like Fodor's have a role. So I read Fodor's argument. A better one is I read The Language of Thought 2, where there's a really clear statement of his argument that we never learn concepts. No concepts can be learned. They must all be innate. I read the argument and I thought, bloody hell. Well, that's what I thought first. Bloody hell. Then I thought, bloody hell, that's a good-looking argument. At no point did I think it was likely to be true. At no point did I think that the conclusion was true. The conclusion was obvious bollocks. But what wasn't obvious was why the conclusion was bollocks. And it seems to me this is the role of arguments when it comes to articulating a metaphilosophical and sometimes metaphysical position is that they're a bit like Kuhnian normal science. You owe it as an anti-reductionist to say what's wrong with Fodor's reductionist argument. You owe it as any sensible person to show what's wrong with his argument in The Language of Thought too. So I think they're something like this. They are akin to what McDowell describes as a mediated epistemic standing in the space of reasons. They're akin to it. It doesn't fit very well, but here's a thought, there's a comparison. So in a paper, in a chapter on knowledge by testimony, McDowell wants to provide a way in which it's possible to acquire knowledge by listening to what people say. And it's possible to acquire that knowledge without being in possession of an argument that proves that that person is likely to be reliable. And the reason for that is, well, we're never going to have that. So if the cost of showing that knowledge by testimony is possible is to provide an argument which shows that that person is going to be reasonable, we'll never have any knowledge by testimony. And so what McDowell suggests is this, that we acquire knowledge by testimony because such we are in a mediated epistemic standing in which the standing is mediated by the rational support of surrounding considerations. So if I have reason to believe that this person is unreliable, then that undermines the prospects of getting knowledge from him or her. In that the concept of that standard cannot be applied to a subject who's not responsive to that rational force. So someone who's just gullible and accepts everything anyone tells them doesn't acquire knowledge by testimony. There's just too much luck involved in that. But that's not to say, McDowell continues, that the epistemic satisfactoriness of the standing consists in the rational force. So you've got to be responsive to the surrounding arguments about what would be reliable and unreliable. But it's not the case that in order to acquire knowledge from someone else, you need to be in a position to articulate what the argument is that shows that that person was reliable. Responsiveness to argument is a constitutive feature, it seems to me, of philosophical commitments. You simply do not count as an anti-reductionist if you're not prepared to take on Fodor. So to be an anti-reductionist is not just wearing the T-shirt. But that's not to say that you become an anti-reductionist from a theory-neutral standpoint, starting point, and then you tot up the arguments and you end up, I'm an anti-reductionist, or I'm a reductionist. It's not arrived at as a result of argument. Rather, these commitments shape the nature of what an acceptable argument in philosophy is. And I think one way of picking this out is just Final, and then I'm really done. Okay, so I was thinking as I was rattling home on the train yesterday, what are all the things that I've changed my mind on in philosophy? And lots of things, but here's an obvious one. I used just to be a Humean on causation. I read Hume, this is why I teach Hume. We can't spot the necessary connection in the world. We don't see it when one billiard ball hits another billiard ball. So causation is going to have to be analysed in something like the Humean way. There are some eccentric Australian realists out there who have a different take on it, but that's just not really going to work. And hence I ended up as a Humean. My Damascene conversion was just thinking, hang on, Hume's a reductionist. Hume's reducing causal connections to something else. Well, you don't have to be a reductionist to be a realist about causal connections. And suddenly, with one bound, I was free of all that necessity to do vulgar substantive philosophy. Now, it seems to me that this is the way that changes of mind happen in philosophy, not solely through rational argument, but rather mediated by available arguments, seeing the attraction of a new way of looking at somewhere. So to return to Rachel's question, I don't think we can answer the question about whether the philosophy of psychiatry needs a metaphysics in any justificatory way. Yes, it really needs it, or no, it doesn't need it, we could do it without it. It's not that. Rather, the connection between philosophical commitments and the variety of forms that we call the philosophy or philosophies of psychiatry are shaped by these antecedent commitments. They're what makes it all possible in the first place. Thank you.